Working Cows Podcast, episode 119.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. And I would ask you again, as I did last week, stick around for the end of the show. I got a couple of announcements that I want to share with you. And it is the Christmas season, so I want to share a couple of things with you regarding that as well. But today on the show, really excited to welcome Glenn Elzinga. He's in the wilderness of Idaho, doing some exciting things there with reducing predator risk and increasing stocking rates and doing it in a low infrastructure way at the very least, and some really cool stuff that they've been able to accomplish with some out-of-the-box practices. And his work has been recommended to me multiple times from multiple different places, and so it's good to finally get him here on the Working Cows Podcast. Glenn, thanks for joining me today.
It's wonderful to be here, Clay.
So I've looked online at some of the stuff you're doing, very interesting stuff. You've got a term that you have coined of in-herding, intensively grazing, using herding, not necessarily hot wires and infrastructure, but herders. And Alan Savory talked about some of the things that they're able to accomplish with herders in Africa when I had him on episode 75 of the Working Cows Podcast. And I was intrigued by that. And I've talked to other people who do similar things, like Bob Kinford in his instinctual migratory grazing. And I asked him, I said, do you think that herding is the future of making the cows a benefit to the land in America? And he said, no, I don't think anyone wants to do this work. So you are obviously doing this work, you and the people that work for you. And so I want you to take some time and just pitch to people the triple bottom line benefit of managing cows in this way.
Sure. No, that's really good, Clay. That's actually funny that Alan mentioned that, because I would have guessed that he would have said differently. But, I guess he's got a lot more wisdom. He's got age under his belt. And he's seen the cold, hard reality of the human condition and how much people want to work these days. And let me just tell you a little story regarding that. So one of the biggest problems we have with herding is finding people who can really receive, just have an open slate enough mentality to receive the differences from what people conventionally perceive as herding. Almost everybody coming here believes herding has to do with pushing cows, driving cows, the stock drive. John Wayne and his young proteges, the cowboys, took the cattle from Bozeman, Montana to Belle Fourche, your hometown, South Dakota. And guess what? They weren't herding them in my mind. They were pushing them. They were driving them. Mm-hmm. And so that's the stereotype of what herding is to people. So invariably, it doesn't matter if I got somebody from New Jersey or somebody who's raised in our own Pisimroy Valley, they all come with that paradigm in, various stages of development in their mind. And it partly goes back to who we are. We're predators, and everybody perceives cows as prey animals. And as a result, we're always driving them. We're always taking them to a place. So I've tried using, just trying to morph that paradigm in, seasoned cowboys that have worked for me, all the way to those folks from New Jersey and Georgia and Florida. And I find that the folks from New Jersey and Georgia and Florida are generally easier, not all the time, to get this paradigm in and get them to drop the old paradigm of driving, pushing. So I could see where Alan's coming from, you know, in terms of, you know, who we are as humans and what our tendencies are and what our preconceived notions are. He's right. But on the other hand, I've had really good success after several months of just continually reinforcing what hurting really is in young people, these young impressionable minds. You know, they're not entrenched in paradigms yet. And as a result, after 2 or 3 months, well, you know, I could have them come back the following season, and they're actually becoming very, very effective at that point in time because we've rewritten their paradigms. And you know, what's crazy about it is that the number one cost is investing in these kids. You know, you just put so much money and labor out there. And we've kind of flipped over our paradigm in our mind about how this should work. And it's because there's no skill set out there. I think you've probably heard about Fred Provenza's book called, I think I have it right here. It's called The Art and Science of Shepherding. Maybe this is be something that you'd want to, but it's called The Art and Science of Shepherding. And on the cover, it says Tapping the Wisdom of French Herders. And actually, that book kind of created a lot of paradigm shifts in my mind after we started developing this herding idea. We call it in-herding for intensive herding. And you know what they've done? They've actually created a curriculum in several schools in France and I believe Italy to actually create this paradigm. They're not reinventing it. They're not recreating it. They're actually creating a brand new paradigm. And that's the same paradigm that we're trying to create, where people actually are creating meal planning for animals to maximize their efficiencies, as well as you know, gaining ecological, social, and financial benefits for both, you know, the owners of the land, which, you know, more often than not are government entities, and all the way to the users who, you know, could possibly profit much more efficiently from cattle and sheep and goats that are run more efficiently. So anyway, back to these kids. So the paradigm we shifted out of is maybe we need to think about the education aspect. And they actually are on the hook for that instead of us. So for the first time this year, and we're in transition here, right? You know, I think ultimately we're going to end up in a place where we're going to partner with a university or something like that. And the university is actually going to require tuition, and we're going to get some money out of that because people are starting to recognize that this is something that is needed in this country, and this is something that doesn't exist right now in terms of paradigms. So for the first time this year, instead of paying these crews, we're proposing the idea that they come here and work completely for free. It's an internship, and we give them a place to live. We give them a horse. So we give them a saddle. And they provide their own meals. They provide their own bedroll, you know, but all the other incidentals, transportation, all that are up to us. So I was very nervous about actually heading down this road until we were at the Kavera Coalition meeting. And, you know, I said to Carol, my wife, she and I were down there. I said, you know what? We're not going to pay these people. We're going to call this an internship. And if they work out and they want to come back on year two, then we'd be happy to pay them. But that first 3 months, that 100 days, 110, 120 days of riding, they're going to just work for free because there's so much investment in creating that paradigm in their mind. And you know what? I was continually busy capturing names of young people that want to do this for nothing. Clay, you know, so right. They were excited about it. So I guess I would, you know, mention that to Alan. If he and I were in this conversation with you, I'd say, Alan, but wait, what about this? This is only a small conference in New Mexico. And I have these young people show up and say, you know what? I want to learn that. I'm excited about it. And the testament to, you know, what Fred's found in France and Italy, you know, there's a steady cadre of people who have embrace the new technologies, the new practices, which are reinventing an ancient wheel, actually. You know, if you go into the biblical days where, you know, people like, Jacob, you know, 12,000 goats and whatever, there's no way he was just driving across the landscape. The guy's trying to gain weight just like we are. He's trying to take him to the best grass. He has herding techniques and herding principles down. You know, it's one of the oldest professions. And unfortunately, in just 100 years of time, we have lost the ability to do that. And with it, we've lost an entire cadre of people who knew how to do it. And, you know, these are journeyman people I'm talking about. These aren't somebody you just grab out of the bar and say, you know how to ride? Come on over, saddle up. And, you know, it's somebody who sees it as a professional type series. You know, it's like that of an engineer or a carpenter. It's a journeyman trade. And I got young people excited about it. So I think, you know, my wife calls me the eternal optimist, but I think that Alan Savory might be wrong here, and maybe he's looking in the wrong places, but I'm very excited about young people being able to pull that off. And they're pulling it off for us on this three-legged stool of we're teaching them about the value of intact ecosystems up there, you know, and reinstating those intact ecosystems. And, you know, it's regenerative agriculture, but, you know, for some reason in regenerative agriculture, we get hung up on regenerating already altered ecosystems to maybe a more functional altered ecosystem. And for us, because we're riding and spending a lot of time on 70 square miles of essentially wilderness, we're just trying to regenerate that back to what the functionality was before we showed up, when buffalo ran up there, and we're trying to mimic that. And as a result, you know, we're seeing all these pieces fall back into the ecosystem, like aspen stands and beaver populations and West Slope cutthroat trout, and even interaction with wolves and bears and those sorts of things are very positive now instead of negative interactions. And so they got that ecological part of the stool. The social part of the stool is themselves actually creating a paradigm for a new profession, you know, and I'm excited about that. If more people embrace herding and true herding, and I'm not talking about pushing, I'm talking about getting cattle to perform efficiently on these wild range landscapes and bringing unique nutrient-dense food back to the table of America. Well, I think there's going to be work for these young people to do this, to embrace this kind of paradigm. So from a social aspect, a lot of my neighbors, you know, when we talk at the coffee shop or at the feed store, they're lamenting that their kids have no place in their operation. And I got seven daughters, Clay, and I'm very optimistic that all of my daughters, if they want to be here, we require that they leave and learn from other people, you know, go to school, get a job, bring something back to the ranch. But I feel like I have a spot for all of them. If all seven of them wanted to come back here, and say seven of them got married, which actually would be really cool, Clay. So if you hear of any good-looking, tall, hardworking young men, send them my way. But, you know, so that'd be wonderful. But I think that, you know, I could provide work for all of those people because, you know, with the social and with this new paradigm, we're seeing economic benefits as well. And of course, it's the economy that brings people back to a ranch. And that's what's exciting. You know, we've doubled, actually, we've tripled the amount of average daily gains we've gotten off dry ground. Right now, we're running about 1.5 average on, these are desert landscapes with yearling cattle. These are not calves that are nursing on a mom. These are just yearling cattle that have been weaned, and through herding and meal planning selection, we're actually picking up to 1.5 pounds a day. Whereas, you know, when we used to run replacement heifers up there with the pairs before we switched to a yearling paradigm, those cattle, Clay, would come back with sometimes it was 0 pounds under their belt for the entire summer up there. They grew in frame. And they grew in skeleton, but they lost finish and they lost muscle tone. And they come back, this bag of bones that was ready to, you know, kick into a compensatory gain program, on aftermath grass. But, you know, there's an opportunity cost, of course, when that happens, because, boy, they're just going to eat like no tomorrow to build those body condition scores back up. And we were even seeing it with their cows. They, a lot of cows, especially, you know, the older models, anything over 9 years old, would come back a little shelly off our range allotments, and their calf would grow at the expense of them. And there's an opportunity cost when you bring a cow back that's dropped a body condition score or two. And as a result, you know, it was actually hurting our pocket on our fall pasture, because we could have used that grass to, say, put wean calves on instead of mama cows that kind of needed to pick up body condition scores in preparation for calving. So there was these unseen benefits. And then, of course, we have the wolves. And that was a real, you know, cash outlay, because we're losing up to 14 head a year to wolf predation, and now we lose zero. But then there's just stocking capacity, and right. You know, so that's another increase. You got 80 G's, but you also got increase in stocking capacities, both on irrigated ground and our high desert ground. And right now, our stocking capacities on our private ground, because of these holistic principles of rotational grazing and you know, starting with management intensive grazing and now thinking more holistically about it, we've been able to double those average daily gains as well. So, you know, when you take all those financial benefits of increasing carrying capacity and productivity, those translate directly to profit, because our input levels are similar, especially on irrigated ground. And as a result, because you have financial implications that are positive, immediately you can just branch out into social implications of, you know, having a legacy ranch that you can kind of you know, provide a way for the next generation, even if it's not my kids. You know, it's young people that come to work for me that are desperately hoping to get into this. They have a passion for it. You know, I have so many young people come here to work for me that have a passion for livestock, have a passion for livestock-based agriculture, a passion for, you know, open spaces of the West and how to run cattle up there. But they're hopeless. Their hopes have been dashed over and over again, either, you know, by their family or friends, or why would you ever want to do that? Because all their compadres are going to, you know, school and finance or whatever, you know, real estate. There's few people heading into trades, but when I can offer them some hope, well, there's immediate social implication. And then all of it is going to benefit, you know, our planet ecologically. You know, I mean, I can even talk about carbon for hours, because we've measured it. And, you know, so it's not only local scale, it's not only the beavers, it's not only the cutthroat trout, it's carbon. I mean, we're just sequestering carbon. We're one of the highest areas of agriculture in carbon sequestration, in net carbon sequestration, after we've subtracted, you know, methane emissions, we subtracted petroleum use. And it's because we brought back an animal-based agriculture using the paradigm of social interaction by us to get them to distribute and run efficiently across the landscape.
Very good. Really appreciate that. And we kind of jumped right in there without much context. And there's going to be a embedded podcast episode from the Down to Earth podcast at the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/119. Workingcows.net/119 is the show notes page for today. You can check out an hour-long episode with Glenn on the Down to Earth podcast, and he gives some history and some background there as to what they're doing and how they're doing it. But just for people who might not make that click, could you give me a 30,000-foot view of how you came to start? And I love this way you talk about this, how you came to start hacking this method of using cows to impact land in a positive way.
Well, it was actually the wolves that got us started on that trail. And they were literally hounding us to death. We're losing some cattle every year to wolves. And it was because we were running a very conventional paradigm of livestock grazing in the arid West. What just about everybody does here, Clay, is they open the gates in the springtime. For us, it was May 10. We opened the gates. We got our cattle up there, placed them on the allotment. It's a 70 square mile allotment, 46,000 acres. Completely wild country, ranging from 4,000 to 10,000 feet elevation. And we basically had those cattle, those mama cows, follow the snow line as the snow receded all the way across the summer. And then we went to go find them in November, December. And so the problem with that was twofold. One, we find that if cows are left to their own devices, they generally behave badly. And behaving badly is because they are driven by two herding factors that aren't us. They both start with a G. Would you know what they are, Clay, by any chance? Any ideas? Start with a G, herding factors that are not human herders. They're not even wolves. What are they? Two Gs, two environmental factors that control cattle.
Grass and... I'm not sure.
Okay, for us, you know, because like I said, that 4,000 to 9,000, that was supposed to be the hint. It's gravity, Clay. So it is grass, but it's a...
Yeah, I heard you say that,
it's too. It's a special kind of grass, and it's green grass. So it's really the color green and gravity. So if we're not up there, those cattle are going to follow those two Gs every time. Every time a cow will follow them, if left to their own, you know, wanderings. They're gonna get pushed by gravity, especially if you got a conventional size 1,250 to 1,300 pound mama cow. She's got a calf in her side. She's gonna go downhill, and she's gonna find green grass along a riparian area. Well, you have 55 miles of creeks up there, okay, and all of them were in pretty marginal shape when we got that grazing allotment in 2005, and. Marginal shape means that they were starting to downcut. They lost a lot of riparian vegetation, a lot of the armoring vegetation, such as willows, alders, and birch, were deteriorating. There wasn't any regeneration. A lot of our native plant species were gone. They were being replaced by Poa pratensis, Kentucky bluegrass, which doesn't hold soil very well. And we're actually seeing downcutting happening, you know, where a creek would incise its way down through, you know, a floodplain that had been intact for years. So that was a huge problem for us, because I knew that fish habitat was getting impacted, and I knew that cover was getting impacted. All these temperature gradient problems, you know, associated with the loss of shade along riparian watercourses is hard on trout populations. And we also affected salmon and steelhead populations. So, you know, Carol and I, she's a plant ecologist. She's got a PhD in it. That's my wife. And she's a plant monitoring guru worldwide. She's written books about the subject. And I was a forest ecologist coming into this. This is 27 years now ranching. But before that, that was our history. So we both thought that, wow, we can handle this. We can run these cattle on these ranges and take care of these ecological values. But we were failing. You know, things weren't going downhill much faster, but, well, they weren't improving. So that was a burr under our saddle, you know, and our horse was starting to buck. And we're like, dang it, we can't even pull this off. And then these wolves came along, and it really pushed the issue. They really, really forced our hand, because all of a sudden it was now economics. We were just getting blasted by them, and we lost 14 head one summer, and bang, we were at about $32,000 in cash there because of the value of what those cattle were worth on the end market, especially our direct market. So we scratch our heads in it. You know, you asked to give the 30,000 foot quick view, but, and here we go. This is what really precipitated the thought change. We're Christmas caroling. We do every year at this time of year. It's December now for you listeners who are listening in the heat of July, thinking, wonder what the heck this guy is talking about Christmas caroling for. Anyway, it was December, and we've been off the range for a while, and, you know, we're in denial. We're just trying to lick our wounds and survive financially that fall. We're Christmas caroling at Roy and Jeannie Ellis's house down the valley. Great people. They're older people, and that's who we Christmas carol to. You know, a bunch of us from the ranch grab some guitars, mandolins, fiddles, and we'll go and show up at these people's homes and sing songs to them. And just try to give them, you know, a little holiday cheer. And so we're at their house, and they're such sweet people. They always offer us something to drink and some cookies or something. But we never take them because we got to move on to the next house, right? But as I was in that house singing these things, you know, I love Charlie Russell. Are you familiar with Charlie Russell? You know, he's a chronicler of the early American West. And he painted all these watercolors and oil paintings. And he painted about 6,000 of these paintings, mostly centered in your country, Clay, you know, in the country between Belfouche and Great Falls, and in the big country of the Big Sky country at Montana. And guess what? There's no pictures of barbed wire in Charlie Russell's paintings. At least I didn't see any. And the reason there's no barbed wire is because these guys in these pictures, they got these epic herds of cattle. There's like 3,000 head. And there's about, you know, 8 to 10 guys running them. They each got about 6 saddle horses with them. They got a chuck wagon. They're just taking these cattle to grass, and they're herding them to grass. And boom, it was just one of those stupid light bulb moments. You know, I've been looking at Charlie Russell paintings forever, you know, and here's these people herding these cattle. And I was like, holy cow. Well, why can't we do that? It seemed like such a no-brainer. And I got in a car with Carolyn. I said, why can't we do that, honey? And she's like, what are you even talking about? We just sang Hark the Herald Angels Sing, you know? And she's like, what are you even talking about? I said, why can't we just go live with these cattle? And so that was the beginning of the idea. And, you know, and then it was a whole bunch of things, you know, starting to research that idea and try to reinvent the wheel that we'd lost. The wheel had fallen off the bus a long time ago. And that wheel was down in the bottom of a canyon. We had to climb down there and dust it off and put it back on the bus as a tool to possibly run cattle on public lands. And it's been a hard road to figure it out. I had no idea. You know, I thought it was simple. Hey, heck, you just camp out in a bedroll with a bunch of cows, right? Boom. It's over. Bring your horse with. You know, but... You know, I got a new respect for the Charlie Russell and previous vintage, all the way back to Jacob of the Bible and his uncle that required those 14 years. you know, I got a new respect for that whole set of people over millennia who knew how to do this and live their life to doing this. So that's what we did. We did that.
Cool. So I can tell we've got more than one episode here, just in the easy in the notes that I have done, and I'm not going to try and smash them all into one episode. We'll set up another time and do this if you're game at a future point. But one of the things that you said that stuck out to me in one of the another, I think the YouTube video, it'll be linked as well at the show notes page. You talked about Bud Williams and his stockmanship. And then you were talking earlier about how the Cowboys, which is my favorite movie of all time, by the way. I don't think I've ever told this story on the podcast, so I'll tell it now. I was snowed in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when I was driving a school bus during Bible school, waiting to drive another route on my school bus, watching the Cowboys on my laptop. And I took a picture of it. And I sent my brother the picture, and he responded with what Slim Pickens was saying at that moment in the video. My brother and I wore out 2 VHS tapes of that movie when we were kids, watching it over and over and over again. When he was in college, his roommates bought him a DVD of it because he had worn out the VHS tape and in college, and the DVD didn't wear out, and they hid it from him after a week because he'd watched it twice or 3 times already. So anyways... You talk about they were driving cattle, yes. And Bud Williams wants the cow to have an opportunity to think.
Yes.
And I think that a lot of times when we start to get involved with cattle and we're driving them somewhere, it's because we think we're the only ones there with a mind.
Yes.
And we're not willing to give them a chance to process the information and make a decision on their own. Is that your experience?
Well,
that they have a mind of their own?
You know, the other day I was... It was Monday, just this week, and my entire crew was at the fulfillment center. We have a fulfillment center where we ship our beef at them, and of course, it's coming near Christmas time, and we get really busy there. We're shipping, you know, like 100 boxes, 100 up to 150 boxes every Monday off our internet fulfillment web store. And that's alderspring.com if, you know, a listener wants to just take a look at what we're doing there. But anyway, so everybody was off the ranch. And every 2 weeks, we get to ship finished cattle off to our processor. And so that means I'm back here at the ranch by myself, gathering and sorting about 500 head of yearling cattle into the corrals off grass. And so what we like to do is we evaluate weight as well as fat finish on these cattle as we select them. So I selected about 15. We're going to ship about 12 this week because these cattle will be ready and back after Christmas. So we decrease our slaughter volume. So it's only 12, but I selected about 15 or 16 that I thought were close just by looking at them in terms of fat deposition. So I'm in the corral with these cattle and I'm sorting them. And we got a set of scales there. And I like to run each one individually across the scales. And I don't know why I didn't ever think of this before, but there's this, you know, and I'm sure intuitively I was there, but I just never really put like real live thought and ideas to the process. So I got this one heifer who's a little recalcitrant. She just wants to go back to her buddies. And I got the scale gate open. And it's just me. I don't have a dog or anything like that. And I try to really be really, really quiet. I don't even talk to these cattle. I don't wave my arms. There's none of that. It's all body position. And I'm looking at her and she's looking at me. And I close the gate behind me. And she now has a choice to either stay in the little pen with me. It's kind of a bud box setup, or go into that gate. And step onto the scale, which nobody's really excited about because the scale's wooden. It's kind of rickety. It's a very old scale, but it still works very well. So it's got a wooden floor and it's different than, the, you know, dirt corral they're in, after I sort them off grass into this place and the concrete ramp that leads up to the wooden thing. So, and of course it's moving. Second they put their foot on there. So she weighs about 1,400 pounds, and she puts her foot on there and steps back immediately. And then I just saw this thing happen in my head. It said, go whack her on the butt. Go whack her on the butt and just, you know, get her over that sensitivity to that floor and make her go in there. And but I didn't. Instead, there was something in my mind instead of instinct, you know, human instinct about predator versus prey. There's something in my mind that the likes of Bud Williams had put there. And my mind said, no, step two steps backwards. You know, which is totally counterintuitive for anybody with cows, right? Especially, you know, Clay, I got
more pressure.
I got the sun going down. Okay. And I got a lot to do yet. You know, these are the shortest days of the year and the sun's going to go down at 4 o'clock. And, you know, and I got a whole bunch to do. I got to sort, do another sort. I still got to feed all these cattle. And so I take the two steps back and she looks at me and we stand there looking at each other. And son of a gun, she just steps into the scales and I quietly close the gate behind her. And, you know, I did that with a few more cattle that day and it was the exact same thing. Take two steps back, no arm waving, no nothing, not even eye contact. In a confrontational way. It's not even like, what the heck are you doing? Why aren't you getting, you know, I mean, it was just, it's just mind over matter because the matter in us is saying maker, you know, and the mind in us, when we get trained in these principles, says, let them, let it be their decision. And even if it takes more time, because it's always going to save you time, right? If you let them. Because otherwise you're going to, you know, if she escalated in that corral, I had about 8 more to weigh that were watching this whole thing. They were all going to escalate, you know, and it was going to make everything go slower. And it's just let versus make, you know, we got to let cattle do what we want them to do. There's no need. It's all want, you know, let them do what we want them to do. And that's, you know, that was Bud Williams' maxim and all the people, all his protégés after him, you know, that's, it's pretty much letting them do what we want them to do. And it's exciting when you see that happen and you can take those two steps back, which is totally against years of paradigm, centuries of paradigm of predator versus prey, you know, and then they do it.
Can you talk a little bit about the changes that you've seen in the cattle since you guys started this in-herding? How they act, how they interact with the ground, some of those things.
So that's interesting you bring that up, because I think that one of the most interesting things I see cattle doing is, because we're giving them much more free rein to make decisions up there, they're actually taking the time to learn from each other. When you first started running yearlings up on the range and we just dumped them up there, they would spread out and scatter out. And if we had new cattle up there that we picked up from somebody, because we have partners that raise certified organic grass-fed yearling cattle, and we would turn those up on the range, and guess what, Clay? They would just walk around for about 2 months straight. It was like, I'm sure they were eating a little bit, you know, just stay alive. But it's like they weren't gaining weight and they weren't doing anything. They would just disappear. So now we've created an environment for them that's really secure, because we have parameters, you know, we have boundaries around them. We condition them to being around us on horseback, and they understand that we are now the boundaries. They come off a hot wire training paradigm here where we're practicing holistic planned grazing, basically, you know, a more holistic view of management intensive grazing. So we're running these hot wire cells before the grass is ready on the range, and then the grass comes ready on the range May 10. So they're used to being cell grazed, and we integrate horses in there to replace the hot wire. And so there's a security for them there. They know they don't have to walk 10 miles to figure out where the boundaries of the grass is. They know it's a small encapsulated boundary, and now we are the boundary. So there's security there, but there's a second element that if we're careful, we can facilitate, and it's this learning process where new cattle that come maybe even from your state of South Dakota come onto these range grasses that they've never seen before. You know, they come off open prairie country of South Dakota. Almost every species is different up on our wild ranges in the Rocky Mountains here. And, you know, it's been shown time and time again that, well, that can almost kill an animal because they don't recognize these given plant species. But right. If we facilitate it, what we see happen is this really, really cool thing where we've learned always to bring seasoned veterans up there. So we'll always put about at least 50 seasoned veterans in a group of, say, 400 head up there. And those seasoned veterans, you know, they hit that blue bunch wheatgrass in the spring, you know, it's just green and growing with abandon. They'll put their heads down and just go crazy. And then they'll eat these salt brushes and all these things that become toxic later in the summer that are really counterintuitive for a cow. But they're self-balancing because there's so many species out there. And these cattle are veterans and they're trying all these different things. So it used to be that the new cattle would never pick up on all that diversity. And our mineral consumption was high. But now what happens is it takes about a week and almost all the cattle are categorically running around with their heads down, picking up all these diverse species. And we realized it was all learning. It was all proximal learning. You know, they had somebody next to them that was eating these grasses and they'd put their head right next to theirs and say, what are you eating down there, buddy? And they take a bite and say, wow, you know, that's not really too bad. And then they actually start to develop a resonance based on palates and flavor choices that actually maximize their wellness. And then after about a week or two, Clay, their salt, their mineral consumption dropped precipitously down to almost none. And that's all got to do with behavior. That's got to have to do with removing stress and creating an environment where they could learn from other cattle. So, man, there's a lot going on in that brain of theirs. And it's not what's going on in our brain. You know, we're thinking of all these other thoughts, you know. But they're thinking of things that we don't even know about. And when I see stuff like that happen, I'm excited because they have a different brain than we do. You know, it's similar size to ours. But they certainly got a whole bunch going on up there if we give them the opportunity to express that.
For sure. real good stuff. A couple of things that I can't leave on the table because they've been emailed to me multiple times that I have to cover when I talk to you, is that you guys have successfully, I'm going to use this word and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you guys have successfully integrated with wildlife to the point that predation is very little to no issue at all. Even, I think, if I'm right, to the extent that wolves have passed up your cattle and taken other people's cattle nearby. I don't know if I'm overstating that or not, but that's the way I remember it being shared with me. Is that accurate? And if it is to some degree accurate, what are the mechanics behind that?
So there's two things that happen with the wolf situation. Like I said, we were getting hit pretty hard, as all our neighbors were up there. And so the wolves were reintroduced, and their numbers just went up dramatically. I talked to a fish and game representative probably 6 months ago, Clay, and I think he estimated that there was like 1,200 wolves in our area of Idaho. And they don't have a huge radio collar program going on right now, but that's his guess. And so it was a huge, huge increase from what was there, back in the 90s. There was a few wolves running around. They were native animals that, because we live next to the largest wilderness area in the contiguous United States. It's the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness. It's just all of, if you look at a map, there's no towns in the middle of Idaho, and it's because it's all wilderness. It's this huge blank spot on a map. And, nobody really knew what was out there as far as native species in terms of, wolf populations and stuff. There was a few. And then come the 90s, wolf reintroduction kind of came into full swing. And Fish and Wildlife Service kind of spearheaded this wolf reintroduction plan. So that was very, very successful. I remember when those wolves came in, I went nose to nose with one in one of the transportation crates and just looked at him in the eyes. I was 6 inches away from him. And I was like, are you the end of me? Because as a rancher, I was like, this could be the end of what we do and the way we do it. And it certainly changed things. It was a huge game changer. Because they did so well. There was so much game. And, of course, there is unlimited amounts of cattle in peripheral countries to the wilderness. So that was one thing. They did very, very well. They were very successful. But they reached a tipping point where Fish and Wildlife Service turned over the management of this kind of reintroductory population thing to the state of Idaho. And as a result, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game appointed by the governor and his task force said, hey, can we actually start hunting them? And so first of all, ranchers were allowed to shoot them. And then subsequent to that, not too long afterwards, there was actually a season open on wolves. And now that season has kept things at a very sustainable level. The wolves are sustainable. There's still a lot of hunters complaining about elk population shifts and demographics of elk and distribution. And, there's talk still of continuing downfall of elk numbers. But I don't know if that data is really secure. Nobody really knows exactly what the dynamic is there. But regardless, people are shooting at wolves. And I think last count was there's probably, 150 to 200 wolves being killed in the state of Idaho every year. Some of them by, multiples by one individual. And so what that means, Clay, is, it's a huge game changer for us because, as we know, wolves being top of the food chain predators are also extremely smart. They're canids, right? I run border collies. They're super smart dogs. When you get stuff put into them, it's amazing what kind of intuition they have, And so wolves came from Canada and they had so much of this intuition, instinct bred into them. And part of it was just real wisdom concerning the true top of the food chain predator, which happens to be humans. And when people start shooting, taking whacks at these wolves, they got trained very, very quickly. It was a very efficient training tool. And as a result, human presence is now their number one anathema. You know, for them to colonize a habitat, to have humans up there is the number one thing. And that's the game changer for us. It's not like we're shooting rubber bullets at them, or, you know, smashing on pots and pans in camp or anything like that, or urinating around a perimeter or cattle. There's nothing like that, Clay. You know, it's just us being there. That's been the game changer. And as a result, the wolves have had nothing to do with us. And yes, some of my neighbors have still sustained some losses. It's just because they're not up there all the time like we are. We're up there 24/7, 365 during the grazing season. We always have people up there. They're always within 100 or 200 yards of every animal we have up there. And as a result, we see them every now and then. We cut tracks. But they're always on the extreme periphery of what we're doing. They just have no interest in cohabitating with us.
And when you started this, you were impacting, if I remember right, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of the riparian area. Is that right?
Yeah, it was more like 65. So 65, okay. That 55 miles of creek we're impacting. And now we've measured it in the past 3 years in a row. It's always been under 1,000 meters. Impacted in any way. This is a cow footprint to, you know, somebody actually bringing a herd down there to get a drink. That's all within that 1,000 meters of the total 55 miles. So it's less than 1% now of all the riparian area on the allotment is now being impacted by cows in any way.
And can you tell me what that means at the riparian level? What benefits are there for that? And why are you taking time to measure that? Some of those things.
So, you know, there's a bunch of things coming down the pike at us. And right now, with regard to the Trump administration, there's been kind of a stepping back from environmental degradation associated with livestock grazing on public lands. But, I know it's still out there. There's still a lot of activity. We have this thing called the Western Watersheds Project here, stationed here in Idaho. That actually has a long litigative reach all across the West to where people are getting sued to manage their cattle differently, if not remove their cattle from public lands grazing. And there's more and more environmental groups gathering forces there to try to end public lands grazing categorically. And it's, Clay, it almost all has to do with riparian condition. And, aquatic habitat. And it's because of those two G's, right? It's where cattle go. You know, they're going to go to the green and they're going to follow gravity. And of course, they're going to end up in riparian areas if they're left to manage to their own devices. So 95% of all the impacts on public lands that cattle are responsible for that are perceived as adverse by the environmental public occur in riparian areas. So that's why it was the first game changer for us because, you know, we have this grazing allotment. It's a key part of our grazing, of our operation. And it's a key part of so many people's grazing operations in the West. Yeah. You know, sure. In terms of total numbers of cattle in the United States that run in public lands, it's small. It's in the single digits, but yeah, it's created an economy in the West, of people who live and interact with this land in these big open space states. So, you know, Carol and I have always been passionate about there's got to be a way to do this. There's got to be a way to do this responsibly. And there's got to be a way to do this actually that's regenerative and restorative in these riparian areas. And that's why that was one of the key reasons why inherding came about, because we knew that if we had total control of those livestock and actually trained them not to use riparian areas, it would be such a game changer. And, you know, if you go to the holistic folks and savory folks, they're like, no, everything needs impact grazing. And, it's an interesting thought. And I think it's actually true. But Clay, here's the deal with these riparian areas in the West, post-settlement, which in our area happened 1860 to 1870. These riparian areas were categorically used every year without a break for well over a century. We're talking 135 years of continuous grazing on most Western riparian areas. You know, sure, we invented rest rotation grazing systems in in the 70s, and we said, oh, you know, this is going to fix some of these things, but it didn't. It just put stuff in static equilibrium. But so these riparian areas have just been exposed to continuous grazing, unmanaged, essentially for 135 years. And let me tell you, folks, it's time to give them a break and let them reestablish. And, you know, rest is important as impact. And so in these areas, we just see so many species just appearing out of nowhere that we've never seen before. And, you know, we see sage grouse now, which is, you know, potentially listed species in the American mm-hmm. West, just taking off, no pun intended, like crazy in these riparian areas. And I think we're missing some of the keys to what happened to sage grouse. And, you know, a lot of people think it's cows, 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 and habitat degradation, you know, but then you'll see stuff on the other side where sage grouse strutting grounds are these open areas along fences. And it's like, well, cows facilitate sage grouse. How can this be? You know, but what we're seeing these new species show up in riparian areas that I know sage grouse love. Like there's currants and gooseberries showing up like crazy now that have long been kind of barely surviving residual species just cropped to the dirt every year by cows browsing them. And now these things are taken off. Now we have so much more cover and we have so much more sage grass. So I think between cover, you know, protective cover, thermal cover, and vegetative mast, you know, in the form of berries, these birds are actually doing so much better. And it's because we didn't even know it, but those components were missing from years and years of grazing that happened in the 20s and 30s and led to the eventual massive decline of this bird that was ubiquitous across the northern portions of the Rocky Mountain West. And so now we see the sage grouse taking off, and it's because we just left the dang riparian areas alone. And, you know, so we're seeing these downcut areas be repaired. We're seeing beavers come in and dam these creeks and fix them for us. We're seeing aspen stands just come out of nowhere and regenerate to where you can't even walk you can't even ride a horse through a lot of these canyon bottoms anymore. And, you know, that makes for difficult, you know, bringing those cattle in there to graze for sure. But on the other hand, you know, it's just provided this huge armoring potential and huge stability. And then, Clay, you know, we just got 55 miles of creek on this allotment. I calculate that there's probably 50,000 miles of, you know, perennial creek in the West. What if we regenerated all them from a carbon standpoint? You know, it's just massive. It's just this massive thing that can happen if we just take care of these riparian areas. And if we're responsible with the riparian areas and we show ourselves to be good husbandmen and stewards of these places, I think we can get our credibility back. As you know, there's these bumper stickers that say ranchers or the original environmentalists. I think that's not necessarily true, but it can be. And that's exciting. We can be the environmentalists. We can be recognized as the stewards of these wild landscapes if we just kind of step up to the plate and do what's right there.
Glenn, so much good stuff here. And like I said, I would love to sit down with you again at some point in the future. I do have one more series of questions. If we could do some, and I know these are not short answer questions, but as short as possible.
Especially with me, Clay, I'm a nightmare. My wife says, "Well, you gotta shut up."
I opened this up to my private Facebook group and my private MeWe group, and I got one question that deals a lot with grass finishing. And I wanted to awesome. Fulfill my commitment to that individual. So let me lay out what I think is going on, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong. Is everything that you guys are responsible for, every animal you're responsible for on public land through the growing season, May 10th to November or something like that?
No, so there's 400 head that go up there on public land. So 70% of all the green forage they consume in that year of life is up on public lands. So that's from May 10 to September 15. And it's 70% of the green forage, because our green season, we live at 5,000 feet. It doesn't really occur until, say, late April. That's when our green season starts. And our green season ends like October 15, you know, so they got a month on one end and maybe 2-3 weeks on the other. So 70% of the green forage comes from, that wild range landscape on public lands. But there's another 200 to 300 head that are here under management intensive grazing protocol here, on our irrigated pastures. We have 405 acres of irrigated ground, and, it used to be all hay ground, Clay. And that's where that soil test came from. You know, our tenure, like in 2009, we took a soils test, and, that year it was 2.45 over the entire ranch. We had lows of almost into the ones on soil organic matter. And so we stopped the hay program. We stopped raising monocultures of alfalfa, and we started doing holistic plant grazing, you know, AKA cell grazing, but with intent, to try to regenerate these lost soils. And so we've been doing that ever since. And now we can run up to 300 pasture cattle at home while running 400 head up on those public lands. And we pick up a little bit of hay too. We pick up about 500 tons of hay, that we can't keep up with our pasture cattle. So we'll just, you know, selectively, you know, delineate which pastures that would be. And so, you know, we're able to just graze an incredible amount of cattle here as well. So does that answer that question, or?
That answers. Okay. Yep. So that was kind of what I was wondering, how the public land played into the grass finishing side of it. And so I've shared my screen with you. Can you see that?
Yes, I can.
And we're looking at this question here. What does it take to finish on grass? How to do it right? Starting with no finishing experience, beginning with the end in mind. Skill level, genetics, grazing, all those things. So can you just, in as much time as you want to spend on it, or maybe that's a dangerous way to put that, in as much time as you have to spend on it, could you just kind of answer that question and serve the listener in that way, I guess?
Yeah, so this is to Aaron. Mm-hmm. So for Aaron here, wow, that's a two-hour-long question.
Exactly.
And I'd love you to come out here, Aaron. We can talk about it. But the way to start with this holistic planned grazing thing is, one, just you got to get out there and learn the basics. And, you know, that might be taking a school. You know, Holistic Management International has a really good holistic grazing school that answers the questions to, you know, basically setting your objectives and weighing them against, you know, not only possible outcomes, but also, you know, all these different things that you should consider when coming up with that grazing plan. So that would be a starting point for me. For me, you know, none of that stuff existed in 1993 when Carol and I started this thing. We were taking a Stockman grass farmer at that time. We were reading anything we could about Jim Gerrish. And, you know, we just adopted management intensive grazing. We read Andre Vosine's book, Grass Productivity. You know, we just tried to scratch anything we could about management intensive grazing and cell grazing. I remember we started with like 30 cows and 1 acre paddocks and hot wire. And, you know, we had failure after failure after failure. Taking a short course can sure save you a lot of hard knocks that way. And that's indeed the way to do it. But, you know, it all comes down to, you know, when I think about this whole thing, it's balancing your grass productivity. You're balancing your ecological, balancing soil health, and balancing that against cattle productivity. So it's kind of, you know, it's like this three-legged stool we talked about, you know, the ecological, social, and financial aspects. You know, those things all have to enter into the equation of what works for your place. So there's so much to be learned from the cattle themselves and watching their behaviors and watching what performance you're going to be creating in these cattle just by ocular estimation and looking at what their bodies are doing, looking at what their weight gains are doing. And, you know, my wife, the monitoring guru for plant ecology, always says this thing to me, and it just nags into my head. And it's so important. It's so important. And it has to do with not being able to manage what you don't measure. Mm. And, You know, if you don't know what your ADGs are and you don't know what your grass productivity is based on your stocking rates and all those things, because you don't have any numbers, you don't have any metrics, you can't manage it. Everything's just flying by the seat of your butt. And that's totally inappropriate if you want to end up making money off this deal. So, you know, for us, the scales were imperative to get reconstructed. Even if we had to drive them over to their neighbors, you know, load them in a truck or a trailer and get those weights just to know where we stand. Because, boy, if you're not gaining weight, you know you're in trouble. You know one of those holistic parts is missing. And this would be, I think this would be the number one thing that people are missing in grass finishing. And it has to do with what I was talking about, just lining yourself up and learning from the cow. And what I've learned, the number one thing I've learned from cows, probably with regard to grass and pastures and holistic plant grazing, is that if we don't offer them a diversity of choice for them to be able to self-regulate and maximize their palates, and this is good grass, this is not rank grass, this is good grass that's well managed. If we're not maximizing their choices in a good grass environment, we're gonna end up on the short end of the stick in terms of performance. Because here's the analogy that I like to use. And Joel Salatin actually got me thinking about it when he published that book called Salad Bar Beef back in the 80s and 90s. I don't know exactly when it was published. Mm-hmm. But the salad bar is what you need to take home from this, because, you know, when, say, Clay and I meet and we're going to go out for dinner in Rapid City, South Dakota, and Clay says to me, "Glenn, man, I know you love salad, and this place over here in downtown Rapid has got the best salad bar I've ever seen. It's the best one in South Dakota." And Clay and I go down there, and daggone it, Clay's right. And there's 60 different choices on that salad bar. And you know what? There's chunks of chicken that have been grilled. There's chunks of steak that have been grilled. There's little, you know, lamb chops to be had. This is an extraordinary salad bar, because it isn't a bunch of rabbit food. It's like everything. It's like, holy cow, Clay, you really hit a home run here, dude. This is beautiful. And Clay and I just about founder that night on trying all these different things, and we have a great time. And, you know, he says, "Hey, you know, we got some work to do over in this place or that or the other. We're going to take a look at some pastures. Let's come back tomorrow night again." And so guess what? Clay and I show up, salad bar's out there. It's all there, 60 pieces, 60 different entrees. And guess what? You know, I'm watching Clay over there. He's loading his plate. And dadgummit, you know, he picks something completely differently than he did last night. Mm-hmm. And so do I. And we both sit down and we talk about it and we say, "Holy cow, this isn't what I ate last night, but you know, this is so good. And you know, I had enough of those last night, so I'm sated there." You know, and then he and I have a few more things to do, and we come back the very next night, and there's 60 holes in the salad bar, but now there's some iceberg lettuce, there's some romaine, and there's some tomatoes, and there's some celery, and they're all different kinds of those four items in this entire 60 tray salad bar. And we're like, what just happened? And yet we talked to the attendant, and she says, "Well, you know, this is a salad bar here, and these are salad items. We're giving you what you asked for. This is salad." And Clay's like, "Well, what happened to, you know, this or that or the other?" And I'm like doing the same thing. And she says, "This is a salad bar. We're not offering you anything that we didn't say was here." But what Clay and I are really kind of pissed off about is the fact that we don't have any free choice anymore. And now you just put us in a salad bar feedlot where basically you're just rationing this stuff out and saying, you know, and she even says, "Hey, we measured the nutrition content of all these things and it's there. It's there. My nutritionist found out it's there for a human. You can eat these things."
Yeah.
"And you're going to be all right tonight, you know?" But Clay and I are dismayed. And it's because we were spoiled to death for the past two nights, maximizing our own palates and maximizing our flavor choices. Now, if we think we're good at that as humans, and some of us really are, most of us are actually pretty bad at it. Now go to an animal who has like the whole cadre of instincts, especially a cow who grazes on pastures. they had these instincts intact. And if we don't provide them with that huge salad bar, she or he is going to not do nearly as well. You know, we're going to deal with sickness. We're going to deal with insects. We're going to deal with all these things without plant diversity. And that's the number one thing I would recommend for grass finishing. You know, I talk to a lot of people from all over the country, and some of these people are really struggling. They're getting 0.8 pounds a day. And, you know, they hear about my 3 pounds a day that we get on Alder Spring on our large capacity cattle. And that's like a 2-year-old animal who can eat enough. She's going to get 3 pounds a day on her place. And they're like, I'm getting 0.8. What is happening? And then I ask them what their grass species are. And they say, well, we got some orchard grass out here, and we got a little bit of alfalfa, and we got some red clover. And he said, you know, that's pretty balanced, you know. And according to a lot of animal nutritionists, yes, that's balanced. But it's not. I was talking to Fred Provenza about this the other day. And, you know, he's an animal nutrition expert. He's a human nutrition expert. And he said, we started to find at the end of his nutrition career at Utah State University. He's a PhD researcher there with them. He started to find out that instead of the 70% of their intake, which is comprised of 3 or 4 species on the range, being responsible for their wellness, they're finding out that the 40 or 50 other species that they eat that comprise 30% of their ration are actually the game changers. And it was because of the phytochemical richness they could pick up and the micronutrient composition of those plants that they could pick up that would then complement the energy flow of the lion's share of the plants that then would really, really feed their gut biota and really maximize their wellness, both in terms of ADGs, you know, daily gain, but also in terms of just them just being able to hack wellness from a cow standpoint to deal with parasites, to deal with bugs, to deal with, you know, all these things that we vaccinate for, you know, BRD, BBD, all these things. We dropped all of them after we got this wellness thing figured out, after we got this. Cows can select their own wellness if we pay attention to them and provide that for them. They can do it. They can hack their own wellness. So now the only thing we give them is 8-way, and we don't give them anything else. And we run like 700 head of these a year, and they do very well. Our doctoring rate dropped by 90%. Our death loss is under 2%. And, you know, it's because they're able to self-regulate now. And it's, you know, it's just the way the designer, the way God made this thing. He made animals to be able to select and craft their own regimen, provided that we give them one that mimics nature. And when we get away from what the nature mimic is, where, you know, like on our ranges, I use that as an example. There's 250 plant species up there that they graze commonly. There's 550 that they graze incidentally. And that's out of 2,500 different plant species. And a lot of people think, oh, that's because you're in the Rocky Mountains. But, you know, I gave a talk in South Dakota, and I actually measured, or I had my wife research what the plant diversity was in South Dakota, south of Rapid City, along the interaction with the Black Hills coming off the High Prairie. And it was 2,200 native plants that used to be in South Dakota. So, you know, we're thinking about those bison out there, you know, and self-regulating. They just had this cornucopia diversity to pick from, and a ton of phytochemical richness, a ton of solar collecting plants, you know, all the way down to ground living plants, to big blue stem that was waving in the wind 8 feet high. They just balanced themselves, you know, and they were able to hack this phytochemical thing so easily because the salad bar was never ending for them. It was never ending. And the thing about the prairie, you know, in a lot of the tall grass prairie states, with that 2,500 native plant species, most of those were palatable to a grazing animal. Whereas, you know, here in the Rocky Mountains, only say about 1/4 of them are palatable to grazing animals. You know, I mean, they're pine trees and all kinds of other stuff, you know. So anyway, I hope that answers Aaron's question. It was very sketch in terms of trying to nail things down, but without, you know, being there on the place with them, it's just really hard to determine. But the key take home, and, you know, Fred Provenza would echo this all day long. He's an animal nutritionist, and he knows far more about this than I do from a scientific and why aspect. It's diversity. The key, the centerpiece of this whole thing is diversity and providing cattle the opportunity to select their own plants.
Awesome. Very good stuff. Thank you so much for your time. I probably way understated the amount of time this was going to take in the email lead up to getting this done, but I really appreciate your generosity, and I thank you for coming on today.
Oh, it's just a lot of fun, Clay. So, yeah, let's do it again sometime because, man, you know, it's just a gift to be able to swap information. You know, whenever I do one of these things, people email us directly and they say, hey, we saw this, mm-hmm. or hey, can I share this with you? And so invariably, you know, when we come to this informational platform, there's no one way thing. I get deluged by more new ideas, and I start being able to think outside of the box I've created for myself. So that's really exciting stuff. Thanks again, Clay.
So we're right in the Christmas season. If I get it out on the 16th, and people wanted to order some steaks from you guys, what link should I put in the show notes page?
Oh, just go to thealderspring.com. Yeah, alderspring.com. So that'd be great.
It'll be there.
So,
all right.
Yep. So more than anything, I wish they'd just shoot me an email. I don't really care if they order beef because, you know, for this context, Clay, the exciting thing for me is that I really believe there's hope in agriculture. Mm. You know, we've just lost our way. Yeah. And I really, really believe there's hope in agriculture. And there's so many people passionate about it who just love the land. They love cattle. They love what God, you know, put under our feet, and they're just fascinated by it all, and they have a passion for it. And I'm like, wait, buddy, you know, sure. If you read Beef Magazine or something like that, you can get lost in their paradigm. You know, you can get lost in their paradigm. And Mike Calcrate's right. We've lost our market. But we've also opened the door to a different way of thinking about the land and creating a relationship with those things we've lost relationship with. And that's so exciting to me. That's wonderful.
Awesome. I look forward to another conversation with you in the future. And thank you so much again for your time today.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, it is the Christmas season. And if you have found yourself sitting around thinking, you know, I really enjoy the Working Cows podcast. I wonder how I could send a Christmas gift to Clay there as the host. And if you have found yourself thinking that, I would just encourage you to check out the show notes page for a link to the Amazon wish list of the Working Cows podcast. My wife and I recently got a livestock guardian puppy who is not ready to live outside yet. We're just getting him kind of acclimated to the neighborhood, and he chewed up a pair of my headphones. So they are back on the list. They were generously sent to me by a listener, and now they find themselves back on the list there. So no pressure. The Working Cows podcast is and always will be free. But if you want to generously support in that way, the Amazon wish list is a really neat way to do that. And there are some new high priority items on there as I look towards going to the conference in Canada and wanting to have a little bit more mobile way to record on the go. There's some stuff there that you can find. So if you're interested in that, show notes page for today, workingcows.net/119. Coming up next week on the show, we will be joined by Dallas Mount, and we're going to talk to him about conducting efficient and effective meetings and planning and reflection and all of those things. And really excited to be joined again by Dallas Mount on the next episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.